Okay, everyone, so let's get started and see what we have for tonight. Okay, Venerable Sir, in this afternoon's class you mentioned about the khandhas and how when you lower the activity it assists the process of meditation. For me the penny dropped. It is the same as the five aggregates. Exactly. Can you please elaborate? Yes, I wasn't very clear that the khandhas are normally translated as the five aggregates. Yeah, but I personally don't really like that translation. The five aggregates to me doesn't really mean very much. I prefer to call it something like the five factors of personality or something like that, because they are aspects of our ordinary experience, aspect of our personality. That is what these things really are. What you're saying here is basically right, but I wouldn't say that when you lower their activity, it assists the process of meditation. I would rather say that the process of meditation actually is the lowering of the activity of the khandhas. As you allow mindfulness to arise, as you allow peace to come, meditation happens by itself, and that actually is the khandhas slowly settling down, becoming more peaceful, gradually disappearing, the body disappearing, certain feelings disappearing, certain perceptions disappearing, the will fading away. That is actually what it is about. So that's exactly what you're saying is exactly right. And the five aggregates, and that is basically what you are experiencing right now. Yeah, that's the five aggregates. Okay, so I hope that you are happy with that. Okay. To the sweet nun with a radiant smile, your smile makes my day. Okay, well, that's very nice, isn't it? Yeah, good. So I'll put that aside for the sweet nun and pass it on to her later on so she can... There's a nice smile on this one as well. That's very good. Okay. Dear Ajahn, pardon me for my ignorance. I pardon you. You are pardoned already here. No problem, sir. When the Buddha became enlightened, does it mean he attained Nibbana? And when he died, it was Parinibbana. What is Parinibbana? Okay, so when the Nibbana has like two stages, yeah? And the first stage is when the person becomes awakened, when you become an arahant, when you become a Buddha. That's the first stage, and that is really what is normally meant by attaining Nibbana when you become an arahant. That is when all the defilements disappear and suffering is basically mostly gone. Yeah, and then there is a second stage of Nibbana, which is often called Parinibbana, and that is when the arahant dies, yeah, and the body and all the khandhas and everything comes to an end. So there's two stages, and while the arahant is still alive, they are kind of looking forward to the final parinibbana when everything comes to an end. It's a nice little verse in the Theragata. The Theragata is the verses of the elder monks. And the verse of Sariputta says something to the effect that being an arahant is like a workman waiting for his wages. Yeah, the work is finished. The work finished, the day you become an arahant, and now you're just waiting for your wages. That is the moment you die, the final elimination of all trouble and suffering. So the arahant has a little bit of trouble left, not much, just like the body still being painful sometimes, that sort of thing. And then eventually you pass away. So these are the two stages. And both are called Nibbana, and the last stage is sometimes called Parinibbana. When one becomes a stream enterer, one has seven lifetimes, including this one. Is it including this one or not? I'm not sure. Anyway, to attain Nibbana, does it mean within that seven lifetimes that he has to be a once-returner, and then a non-returner, and finally an arahant? It means that within seven lifetimes, you become an arahant. That's what it means. Yeah, whether you have to be a once-returner, a non-returner, that will all depend on what kind of progress you make. Sometimes you can make quicker progress. You don't necessarily have to go through all of those stages. Often you do. The common path, probably you do, because it's gradual. Yeah, but sometimes you can make quick progress. Like the Buddha, it seems he went straight from being an ordinary person straight to becoming arahant, just like that, because of the power of his wisdom or whatever. So, yeah, so that's when you become an arahant. And last but not least, thanks for doing the sutta retreat. Will you consider changing the retreat to a warmer season for the benefit of sentient beings who have fallen ill during this cold weather? It's true, there's been a few people falling ill, yeah? Now even Ananda over here has kind of doesn't sound too good, yeah? Whereas Dukkha. So yeah, that is a good point. Some people said that this time of the year is quite good because some people are school teachers and it's a good time of the year for them to come here. Yeah. So that is one reason I've been doing it at this time. Let's see what happens. Yeah, future always unknown. I can't promise anything because there's so many things. This is a very complicated equation we have at the monastery, trying to fit everything. And I can assure you, we're kind of struggling, yeah, to kind of fit all the pieces together of this jigsaw called the schedule for the senior monks at the monastery. It's not easy. So, many thanks. Signed by an ignorant being. Yeah. Okay. Very good. P.S. Even if you don't consider having this retreat in the warmer season, we would rather fall sick than miss this retreat. Good. Okay. Okay, very good. That's very, very good of you to say that. So, that's... okay. Excellent. Next one. Dear Ajahn, I have seen a big, tall statue of a lady Buddha in Cambodia or Laos. Not sure where. Any idea of this lady Buddha? Can ladies attain this status? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Lady Buddhas. Oh, well, I'm not so sure. They're not very common. The only kind of lady Buddha, which is not really a Buddha, is like Kuan Yin is the most common one. Huh? But that's usually quite different. It's usually more like a Mahayana type statue. Huh? But there's some interesting stories. There's always interesting stories everywhere. The more you know about the Pali literature, the more kind of stories there are in there. And when there is one story, it seems, of the Buddha being a woman in a past life. That's almost like kind of almost being, you know, like on the path to becoming a Buddha, being a woman. That's kind of a very rare story. I think it's only one of them, hidden away. So I'm not even sure where it is, actually, that story. So there are some stories like that. But a lady Buddha, this is almost unheard of in Buddhism. Whether it is possible or not, however, it's a very interesting question. Because to know whether it is possible is actually not as easy as you may think. If you read the suttas, it often will say, there's a couple of places in the Theravada suttas where it says that a woman can never become a Buddha. But then when you look at those suttas and you compare those suttas with equivalent suttas in other traditions, like the Chinese and etc., yeah, these are suttas that come from the same source, everything gets much more complicated. And Venerable Analia, who was one of the leaders in the comparative studies between the Pali, the Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, all of these various sources, he says that quite possibly there was no such saying in the earliest teachings of the Buddha that a woman cannot become a Buddha. Yeah. So it just depends, I suppose. It depends on the conditions, depends on the circumstances, whether, you know, it is a... Given the right circumstances, it may very well be the case that a woman, too, can become a Buddha. So, basically, I think that is not as cut and dried a question as people sometimes think it is. There you are here. Dear Ajahn, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka. These terms all look similar here. Does it mean love and kindness or something else, something deeper? Thank you, Ajahn. There's a lot of similarity, I agree with you. There's a lot of overlap between these terms, but they're not exactly similar. They're slightly different ways of giving rise to happiness and giving rise to joy in the mind. The metta is like seeing the good qualities in others, yeah, and then kind of feeling happy because you see the good qualities in other people, focusing on the positive side, yeah, coming in here thinking, wow, how wonderful it is to be in the company of so many good people. That's metta. If you come in here and you fault find, that's the opposite of metta. Yeah, oh, they're making a noise. Oh, that's anti-metta. Metta is like, yeah, everyone must make a noise every now and again. It's just, you can't sit completely still all the time. You've got to move a little bit or whatever it is. It's okay. Yeah, Yeah, metta. Karuna is seeing suffering in other people and wanting to help other people relieve them of their suffering. That's karuna. Yeah, it's this movement inside of you that wants to help the suffering in the world. It's a little bit different. It's called compassion in English. It's a little bit different from empathy. Empathy is where you take on other people's feelings. Yeah, somebody else is suffering and you feel similar to how they feel. It's like you take on board their feelings, so you kind of empathize with their feelings. But that is not really what we're trying to do in Buddhism. If you empathize too much, you get exhausted very quickly because you have to feel what everybody else feels. Instead, you have this movement wanting to help others. You don't necessarily have to take on board their feeling. You just know that they're suffering, and so you want to help them. That is karuna. May all beings be happy and well. May they overcome all their suffering. Yeah, this is karuna. Without actually becoming too upset about that. If we take on board too much of the negative feelings and we allow ourselves to be kind of dragged down by the suffering of the world, it's just counterproductive. It doesn't really work anymore. You have to keep a positive mind state. And this is one of the interesting things about the suttas. You will see that metta comes always first, then you have karuna, then you have mudita, then you have upekkha. And I think the reason for that is that metta is a safer bet than karuna. You can never go wrong if you focus on the good qualities in other people. Yeah, nothing is wrong with that. But with karuna, when you try to do compassion and you focus too much on the suffering in the world, sometimes you can get a bit kind of, down because of all the suffering. You can't take so much suffering anymore. So it's actually more difficult to do karuna properly than metta. Focus on the good qualities is never wrong. It always has a positive outcome for you and also for your relationship with other people. And then you have mudita. Mudita basically just means joy. Yeah, it means like an uplifted mind. So it's not so easy to understand what it means in this context. So usually the way it is described is like this idea of rejoicing with other people. Somebody else does well and you think, yay, good on you. Yeah, what a wonderful thing that you had a good meditation. Yeah, instead of sometimes people get jealous if other people get good meditation. That's kind of the wrong way. Instead, you rejoice in that. You think it's wonderful. If somebody else can do it, it means you can do it as well. Yeah, that's the right way of thinking about it. Instead of, thinking negative in a certain way. And upekkha, this is the highest of the Brahma Viharas. And that is where you just look on with equanimity. Yeah, your mind is perfectly in balance. And the reason this is the most powerful of the Brahma Viharas is because when you come to equanimity, you have gone beyond all feelings, either positive or negative. And because you have gone beyond all feelings, positive and negative, your mind is in complete balance. You're able to gain, you don't have any kind of attraction to positive feelings or whatever. You're able to gain insight into feelings more easily and understand that upekkha, equanimity, the balance of mind, is actually preferable. It's a better feeling to feel just upekkha than it is to feel positive feelings. It's hard to imagine, but that's actually the reality according to the path. And that enables you to have better insight into feelings because you have gone beyond all the good feelings in the world. This is the highest kind of ability. Upekkha means like looking on. That's literally what it means. You're just looking on. No reaction. Yeah, just aware, completely unreactive. This is what happens when you get to the fourth jhana and these kind of things. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, does smoking break any of the eight precepts? Ooh, okay, are you afraid of that one? A little bit nervous. What if I said yes? Would that be bad for you or would it be okay? Would you be happy still? Maybe you're talking about someone else. Maybe it's not yourself. And the answer is not really. There is nothing really about smoking in the suttas. And it has been quite common until very recently for monks, for example, to smoke. Monks in Thailand, especially, many of the very famous monks in the Thai forest tradition, for example, who used to smoke because they started out maybe in the 1960s or 70s. And in those days, nobody really had a clue about smoking being bad and all of that. So they would smoke. It was part of kind of what they did. It doesn't really have a very intoxicating effect when you smoke. At least that's my experience. You get a bit sick perhaps in the beginning, but you don't really get so intoxicated. So I think it's, you can, if you are addicted to cigarettes, I don't think it's a big problem. That's okay. It's a problem for your health, perhaps, but I don't think it's a problem for your spiritual advancement. So the answer is basically no. It's not against the precepts. Doesn't mean I would recommend it. It's just not against the precepts. Ooh. Okay. Hi, Bhante. The five indriyas are said to be qualities for the Aryans, but they are qualities by which the Buddha describes his two previous teachers in Majjhima Nikaya 26. So there must be ideas known at the time, and the Buddha redefined them. Is that true? That is an interesting question. I'll just read the rest of this because the last part is very nice. Thank you for your kindness and wonderful teachings. You are still very cool, especially no smoking. Okay, good. So that is an interesting question, and it's actually not as easy to answer as it may seem. Because always when you look at these suttas, it is never really enough just to look at the Pali canon, because the Pali canon only gives you the kind of the Theravadan perspective of things. And remember, it hasn't always been preserved verbatim from the time of the Buddha to now. In texts that are 2,500 years old, there's bound to be slight errors creeping in, difficulties with memorizing and all of these kind of things. So really, if you want to have a clear review of what is going on, you have to compare them to other ancient texts that kind of split from the Theravada tradition 2,300 years ago, around the time of Ashoka and that. So you look at the texts that have been translated into Chinese, you look at any fragments that exist in Sanskrit, some things that have been translated into Tibetan, you bring it all together, and then you study these suttas. And there is one monk who has done more of these kind of studies than anyone else, and his name is Venerable Analayo. And he's one of these people, very, very gifted with languages. He reads Pali, Sanskrit, ancient Chinese, Tibetan, German, French, English, Italian, Russian. I don't know, it's just like, it's kind of mind-boggling, yes? So because he's so gifted, he can take all of these sources and he can put them together and then compare. Yeah, and some of the languages that he is looking into, languages you would never even have heard of, these languages, because they are so obscure. Like Sogdian. Have you ever heard of Sogdian before? No, it was an ancient language that existed about 1,500 years ago. And some of the ancient scriptures happen to exist in Sogdian, in Khotanese. Yeah. Uyghur actually, that still exists today in Western China. Some of these suttas exist in ancient Uyghur as well. So there's all kind of weird stuff going on there. So you compare all of these things together, and one of the things you find when you compare Majjhima Nikaya 26 with the Agama version, the Chinese version of the sutta, is that that sutta does not say five indriyas in the sutta. It says only three of the five. The two that are missing are mindfulness and stillness. Samadhi and sati are missing. Yeah, so what's going on here? How come the Pali version has the five indriyas here? The Chinese version only has three of the five. Which one is correct? How can we actually decide that? And one of the interesting things about this particular Chinese version of this sutta, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, is that it is actually shorter than the Pali version. And it is missing some of the more supernatural elements that you find in the Pali version. By supernatural elements, I mean like when Brahma comes down and asks the Buddha to teach. That is completely missing in the Chinese version. So I think that there are some grounds for thinking that the Chinese version may be a simpler and earlier version than the Pali one. That is one way of deciding what is earlier. The other one is a principle. These are principles that were used to study the Bible a couple of hundred years ago, and they're now also being used somewhat in Buddhist studies. This is the idea that the more unusual reading is more likely to be correct. Why is that? And the reason is because over time, things tend to get standardized. The editors, the redactors go into the text, and things become standardized as a consequence. If you make a mistake in reciting, you tend to move towards standardization, usually, when you make it a mistake in recitation. So things over time become more and more standardized. Less and less of the idiosyncrasies of the text tends to remain. So I think for that reason, the Chinese version, again, is more likely to be correct, because three of the Indriyas is a much more idiosyncratic way of presenting these teachings than if you have all five. So what does that mean? And what it means, I think, is that we're not really talking about here the Indriyas in exactly the same way as they were used later by the Buddha. We're talking about something slightly different. We're talking about qualities of mind that were there, but not fully developed in the Buddhist way. The other thing to remember is that the Buddha, he used concepts and ideas that were existing in India at the time, and it changed those ideas and gave them new meanings. We just saw the word arahant before, how the Kalamas would invite the Buddha, oh, it's good to see such arahants. They obviously didn't really know what arahants were, not in the Buddhist sense anyway. The Buddha took on board these words and used them in new ways. Yeah, this is also another important principle to be aware of. So these, depending on the context, sometimes words may have the precise Buddhist meaning. Other contexts may have a more general meaning that was applicable to Indian society at that time. So things are not cut and dry. Yeah, you can see how sometimes when you study these things, actually things come up which makes it less obvious. So for that reason, I think in the Buddha's teachings, when the Buddha is talking about his Dhamma, he means that when the five Indriyas are really established in you, yeah, just like in a sense the Eightfold Path is established in you, when you have got the five Indriyas, that only happens when you become a Saddhanusari or Dhammanusari. This is the stage just prior to become a stream entry. Saddhanusari means like a faith follower, Dhammanusari, a Dhamma follower, yeah? And at that point is when you gain those faculties, they become part of you again. They become part of your psychology. Prior to that, we try our best to get as close as we can to those five faculties, but we don't get there perhaps 100%. That only happens later on. So again, things are always, you know, not 100% straightforward, unfortunately. That's what we can expect when the texts are so ancient. Anyway, so that's a little bit for you on the technicalities of various suttas and canons and all of these kind of things, which I find very interesting. I don't know, maybe you have to be really into the suttas to find it really interesting, but I hope you don't mind me going into those things a little bit. Okay, dear Ajahn, I thought listening to the Dhamma gives one joy and inspiration, leading to kinder thoughts. Isn't intending to Dhamma, giving ear to Dhamma, a meritorious deed? Okay, so if you are intending to the Dhamma, and I think probably there is something to that, yeah? If you are intending your ear to the Dhamma because you have a pure mind and all of these things, that can become a meritorious deed. It obviously depends a little bit on how you do it. But if your intention is a good one, you want to learn, you want to become wiser, yes, I think you could argue it is meritorious. But remember, in Buddhism, the real merit becomes much more powerful when you, actually act yourself, when you do something quite deliberately. That is often where the highest merit is. Also in meditation, of course, if you're able to overcome hindrances and move towards meditation, that also becomes, of course, a powerful source of merit. So if you use these things in the right way, I think you have a point. You're using it almost like a meditation object by purifying yourself. So, yes, I would agree with that. Number two, which one sutta you refer to that one could choose metta for oneself first? The idea of choosing metta for oneself first is actually not found in the suttas. It is actually found in the Visuddhimagga. That's where the details of metta meditation are spelled out. And they have this idea that you start off with yourself, and then you have your people who are kind of considered friendly, and then you have the neutral, and then you have the kind of the difficult people. Yeah, it's a system that has been devised in the Visuddhimagga. It doesn't really exist in the suttas. I don't want to get into too many technical details, but there's another very interesting paper that was written by the same monk I mentioned before, this Venerable Annalayo, where he studied the origin of this idea that you should have metta for yourself first. And it seems to come from a phrase in the suttas which says that, which is often translated as you have metta to yourself as you have to the whole world, or to the whole world as you have to yourself. Yeah, and he argues that that actually is a mistranslation. And he makes a very strong argument for that, based on comparative study with other suttas, based on various versions within the Pali Canon itself, depending on where you look. One of the interesting things about the Pali Canon is that it exists in, you know, it comes from all the Theravada countries. Yeah, Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, they all have their versions of the Pali Canon. And sometimes they are slightly different. This is what makes it interesting. Sometimes you find an ancient manuscript and you find unusual readings, perhaps. And all of these things you can use to study what actually is the real original meaning. Usually you don't find anything spectacular, but in this case, I think he discovered something very interesting, that actually the meaning here probably is slightly different from what how it is often translated. And, you know, in terms of practice, it doesn't make a massive difference. But this idea that you do it yourself, first of all, is not necessarily supported by the suttas. There's nothing really in the suttas to support that. What the suttas do say, and that is perhaps what I was saying the other day, this is if you go to the Kakkachupama Sutta, the simile of the saw, Majjhima Nikaya 21. It's a beautiful sutta which talks mostly about how to practice metta. And in that sutta, it says, if there is a difficult person in your life, that person is the first person you have metta towards. Yeah? Why is that? And the reason is because if you don't deal with those difficulties you have, if you don't deal with that little irritation or upset you have or whatever, if you don't deal with that, you're not going to be able to overcome that later on. It will block your metta from kind of expanding out and encompassing all. So you deal with that irritation first of all, get rid of all the ill will or negativity you may have, and only then do you move on to the metta. So this is for people who already are very developed. You don't really have any enemies, yeah? This is one of the wonderful things about being a Buddhist. Please don't have any enemies in this world. If you have enemies, that kind of blocks you on the path. Make sure everyone is your friend. If they are not your friend, that's their problem. But at least you are kind to others, yeah? You don't have any enemies. And when you don't have any enemies, wow, life becomes so much easier. It's really commendable and really recommended not to have any enemies. And but still, when you don't, even if you haven't got any enemies, still sometimes, you know, little irritations and upsets may arise in your mind. Then you deal with those first of all. And because you haven't got any enemies, once you have dealt with that, all upset and anger and ill will is gone. Then the metta becomes possible. And that's why you deal with those difficult people first. Get the anger, get the ill will out of the way. Then you go for the metta. Number three, where can I find in the suttas the idea that bhava is a relatively stable kind of existence? Where is the notion of stability of bhava comes from? Well, bhava is bhava means existence. Yeah. So the point is that bhava, once you are reborn in a certain realm, then that's where you stay. Yeah. Once you are reborn as a human, you experience certain things. You can actually, but normally you don't experience things that are kind of outside of human capability. In a sense, when you go into deep meditation, you do exactly that. You go beyond the human state, so to speak, in meditation practice. But generally, as human beings, there is like a limit to what we can experience in terms of happiness and suffering through the five senses. Yeah? So it is a fairly reasonably stable existence. If you get reborn in a Devaloka, it's similar, that it's a fairly stable existence in that Devaloka. If you get reborn as an animal, you can only experience limited happiness as an animal, yeah, because of the nature of that state of being. So once you are reborn, then you are, in a sense, stuck in that state for that period of time. And that is perhaps what you mean here by stability of bhava. Did I say stability of bhava? I can't remember. Did I? Maybe I did. But that if I said that, maybe that was what I was referring to. I can't really remember now what I said anymore. And the idea of a bhava, if you want to read about bhava in the suttas, bhava is found, is defined in the Anguttara Nikaya 3s, suttas number 75 and 76. These are called the bhava suttas, and they explain the notion of bhava, and they show you how your kamma then leads to a particular type of existence. A beautiful simile there of where they compare consciousness to the seed. Kamma is the field, yeah? The seed of consciousness gets planted in that field of kamma in your future life. Craving is the moisture which allows the consciousness to grow in that new field in the future. And very nice simile, which is very evocative of what happens when we get reborn in a particular existence. Can you explain why Anapanasati is in the Girimananda Sutta on Sanya? That is a very good question. This is one of the questions I have asked myself as well before. What is Anapanasati doing in the Girimananda Sutta? It's kind of weird, isn't it? There's many strange things in the Girimananda Sutta. You look at it as a very strange perception they call the Anicca Sanya. And it's not Anicca in terms of impermanence, but Anicca in terms of non-desire. I think it only occurs in that particular sutta, Anicca Sanya, and it's defined in a very different way from how things are normally defined. What else is it in that sutta that is unusual? It's just the number of things in that sutta. There's the monk Girimananda who only occurs in this particular place, yeah, nowhere else. It's another kind of weird thing. Actually, there are a few monks like that who only occur once in the suttas, but still. I think it is quite possible, and I think there's no parallels to this sutta in any other traditions. I think it's quite possibly it's like a late sutta that was compiled sometime after the Buddha. Yeah, maybe there's no mention of the Buddha, I think, in that sutta. Or maybe there is actually, because Ananda goes to the Buddha, he says Girimananda is sick, and he says, well, chant the sutta too. Yes, the Buddha is mentioned there, that's true actually. Still, it looks to me like a little bit like a sutta that may have been compiled after the Buddha passed away, because it is different from most other suttas in a number of ways. So I agree with you. It is strange that Anapanasati is kind of under sanya, under perception. I'm not sure why that is the case. Yeah, it seems like the odd one out there, or is it some special reason? Yeah, don't know. Can't answer that one. Not sure. Thank you so much with Metta. Okay. Dear Bhante, the corresponding tables between the Nikayas and the Agamas, who did that? Does someone or some people actually know both collections so well that they can spend the rest of their lives matching them up for people like us to use? That's amazing. Did the Chinese do that? Do Western scholars? Thank you with metta and gratitude. The first scholars who used to do this, it's actually true, people do this. They spend their life doing precisely that. Yeah, this is it's actually quite right. And the first scholars who did this were Japanese scholars. The Japanese scholars were very early on there because the Chinese canon, because the Chinese characters can be read in Japan. Yeah, it's the same kind of characters that are used in Japan as in China, so they can read the Chinese canon. So they already had access to the Chinese canon in Japan, and it was read by Japanese scholars. And then they started to read also the Pali, yeah, when that became accessible around the world. So some of the early Anesaki was a Japanese scholar, Akanuma, I think. I can't remember all the names, but these were some of the early scholars back in the 1920s. They started to make tables, correspondence tables. And sometimes it's very obvious because some of the suttas are almost exactly the same. It's very clear how they belong to each other. But then in more recent times, some of the Western scholars have been doing this, in particular people like, I was just telling, Venerable Annalayo. And if you go on Sutta Central, which is the website that Ajahn Sujato has been designing and building up over a number of years, and is now finally coming to a very nice stage, all of those correspondences are there on Sutta Central, because he's collaborating with Venerable Annalayo and other people to build this up. So it's all available there. So these are things that are happening continuously. More and more parallels are kind of, as they emerge, yeah, they are being loaded on to Sutta Central. But it's a very difficult work, and sometimes it is not all that useful for most of us, because, if you get a text in Chinese, yeah, you've got to translate it into English, first of all. And most of those texts in Chinese are not actually translated. So unless you know how to read ancient Chinese, not that many people know how to read ancient Chinese. If you ask someone who actually speaks Chinese, yeah, and they still can't understand ancient Chinese because it's so different from modern Chinese, how the characters are used these days. So it is quite involved. So there you are, yeah. I actually know some of these scholars very well because I have been dealing with them and doing translations and things myself. So I actually know these people, and I know exactly what they're doing. They're doing a tremendous amount of work. Basically, a person like Venerable Analayu, he spends all his time. He does two things: he meditates and he does all this comparative study. That's pretty much all he does, and he writes scholarly papers. So he meditates 5 days a week and he does scholarly study 2 days a week or something like that. So he's a very kind of accomplished in many ways, both in meditation and also scholarly. Yeah. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you talk a bit on Vipassana meditation? Is it insight? Is it a progression after breath meditation, if it's correct? How to go about Vipassana? Thank you very, very much. Vipassana meditation. Basically, the answer is that if you go to the suttas, there is no such word in the suttas as vipassana meditation. It does not occur in the suttas. Nor is there a word called samatha meditation. Yeah, these words are not used in that way in the suttas. What you find in the suttas is the bhavana, the citta bhavana, the development of the mind, and that is what really is meditation practice. So there is bhavana, development. And vipassana and samatha, the way it is used in the suttas, are used as outcomes of the practice. So the outcome of the practice, if you practice something in the right way, is two things. Those two things are samatha and vipassana. If you practice in the right way, both of those things arise as a consequence. Yeah? So if you do mindfulness of breathing, yeah, and you become more, and your defilements start to get lower and lower and lower, you're becoming more and more calm and peaceful, that calm aspect is the samatha aspect. But with that calm aspect, when you come out, you also feel a clarity. You can see things more clearly, yeah, because your mind has less defilements. There's less vested interest there that drives the mind into the future and the past. You're more present. You have more focus and all these kind of things. So you also have more clarity. So you also have more vipassana. Vipassana really means something like clear seeing. I think insight is not the best translation for vipassana. Clear seeing is a better one. You have more ability to see the world, the five khandhas, more clearly. Yeah? Yeah, that is the idea of vipassana. I remember writing to Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi a long time ago, and I was commenting on his Anguttara Nikaya translation. I said to him, is it really appropriate to translate vipassana as insight? Insight is like wisdom. When you have an insight into something, it means you become wise. You have already seen something. Bang! Wow, that's insight. Yeah, now I understand. That's wisdom. Vipassana is actually the precursor to wisdom. It is that which gives rise to wisdom. It is seeing things clearly until the insight comes as a consequence. And he wrote back to me, and I was surprised. He said he agreed with me. That was a surprise. But he said that the word vipassana had been translated as insight so long that he wasn't really prepared to change the translation because people kind of got used to that. Yeah, so these are kind of the secrets behind the scenes, what's going on. So that is vipassana. I prefer to translate as clear seeing. So these are the results of meditation. If you meditate in the right way, whatever kind of type of meditation you do, if your meditation works, it gives rise to both these things. Samatha and vipassana go together like two sides of a knife. This is what you will hear from almost all good meditators, from Ajahn Chah down. That's what they all say. They always come together. You can't separate these two things. There is no such thing as one type of meditation which is all about vipassana, another one which is all about samatha. They always go together. So So what does it mean? So is there a distinction then? And the distinction is that what we are trying to achieve on this path, yeah, we are trying to achieve, first of all, samadhi. And the reason we are trying to achieve samadhi is because samadhi is the cause for yata bhuta jnanadasana, seeing things according to reality. That is what we're trying to achieve, see things according to reality. Because when you see things in accordance to reality, you have the data by which you can you can make good decisions in life, basically. To be able to see things in accordance to reality, you have to have samadhi, first of all. So our first goal should always be to attain samadhi. To attain that samadhi, you have to get rid of the hindrances. That is the problem that stops you from getting samadhi. How do you get rid of those hindrances? And this is where things like the Satipatthana Sutta comes in. And there's two things you have to do to get rid of those hindrances. One is you calm the mind down, and the other one is to try to gain some perspective, some insight, if you like, into those hindrances to understand what is going on. So when you meditate, one of the things that you do when you come out afterwards is to look back on the process. And you ask yourself, what were the hindrances? What were the blockages? Yeah, how do these hindrances arise? What are the problems? This is what Satipatthana is all about. You start to understand the process for why the hindrances are there and how you get rid of them. Why is there desire in the first place? And the reason that there is desire in the mind is because you are looking for the beauty. You're looking at the beauty of a particular object. Yeah, if you see all the food, you think, wow, that food looks so delicious. You're going to have desire for the food, yeah? It's because you're looking at it. By withdrawing, by looking at the food in a different way, thinking, okay, I'm not interested in food now, then that desire does not arise because you're not looking at it. So by watching the breath, you are undermining the desire because you're not feeding it. You're not looking at the attractiveness of the objects of the world. So you understand this causality. You see how it is happening inside of you. This is the most important thing, to see how it works in your own mind. Then you can overcome these things. So this is how the insight comes into the picture. Yeah, you become calm. You become more and more still. And as you do that, as part of that process, you also see how the hindrances kind of fade away, how they arise, how they work. And then you get the data for helping you to overcome those hindrances in the future. It's a mixture, sammata vipassana, coming together, being the outcome of the meditation practice. And then once you understand a little bit about the hindrances, you take the meditation deeper, you understand a bit more, until eventually you eliminate them completely. It's a gradual process that you go through. So that is essentially what it is about. There is also, in Buddhism, there's also many other ways of, developing our minds. There is things we call the perceptions. We're just talking about the Girimananda Sutta a second ago, which has all these various kind of perceptions we can develop. And the suttas are full of perceptions. The Anicca Sanya, the perception of impermanence, the Anatta Sanya, perception of non-self, all kinds of perceptions that we can develop. The Maranasanya, perception of death, we'll have a talk about that a little bit later on. And these are also helpful because they kind of straighten out your view. So you look at the world more in terms of the way the world actually works. So your view of the world aligns with the way the world actually is. That's very useful, isn't it? Because that means that you have less delusion in your mind, and that enables you to do the practice better. So you could call those things vipassana practices, but actually the suttas calls them perceptions, development of perception. But you could argue that that is a kind of vipassana, but that's not usually what is called vipassana. Usually what is called vipassana is satipatthana practice. But in the sutta, satipatthana practice is not called vipassana. Satipatthana practice is sammata and vipassana. That is the result of satipatthana practice. Okay, I hope that helps. I hope I'm not making it too complicated, because it's actually not that complicated. So just watch the breath, that's really all you have to do, and then gradually you get there. Dear Ajahn, your simple approach to meditation, be mindful and wait for the breath to come to you, has been very helpful. Wonderful. Could you say a little about walking meditation? Is the same approach best, or something slightly different? Thank you. So walking meditation can be done in a number of different ways, just like sitting meditation really can as well. I would not recommend you to watch the breath while you're doing walking meditation. I know that there are some methods of meditation where that is recommended, but I can't really find any clear reference in the suttas for watching the breath while we're doing walking meditation. So I wouldn't really recommend that. Walking meditation, in the Anapanasati Sutta, it specifically says at the beginning, you sit down. Yeah, that's what it says. So it seems to me that that would be the standard way of doing Anapanasati. So when you do walking meditation, I would tend to do something a bit more active, perhaps. So one of the things you can do, if you like, you can contemplate something. I will talk more about death contemplation later on. That can be useful when you do walking meditation. Yeah. When the body is a bit more active, the mind also tends to be activated a bit more easily. You can do metta while you're walking, yeah? Thinking positively about or kind of developing your mind in that direction. You can do that. Before you do that, though, just to kind of get the basics into place, if you're going to go walking meditation, find a nice stretch of fairly flat land, maybe about 30 paces long or something, and just kind of walk. You can walk back and forth, basically just walking back and forth. And I would recommend you to walk back and forth at a natural pace. Don't try to force the pace. Don't try to kind of walk incredibly slowly and this kind of stuff. Because again, if you do that, you are using force and willpower in your meditation practice. It's not natural. And if it's not natural, after a while, you tend to become a bit tense or uncomfortable or whatever. It's not easy. Allow the pace to come naturally because you are focusing in the right way. Don't try to force the pace to arrive by doing artificial things. That's the way I prefer to do things, because I know it's so much easier. I feel so much more content with my life and meditation if I do things naturally rather than I try to force things to happen. So these are things you can do. And one of the great walking meditation techniques that I was taught, it was actually a monk who came here a few years ago, Ute Janea, is a Burmese monk, has been here a few times, a very nice monk and quite well known these days, travels around the world, gives teachings everywhere. He said that the way he teaches walking meditation is just walk back and forth. Don't do anything in particular. Yeah, just walk back and forth and just enjoy. Be aware of the mind. That's his main practice is a chittanupassana. Be aware of the mind and understanding the defilements of the mind. That's what he teaches. So when you walk, just walk back and forth. Just walk natural pace and kind of be aware of your mind. And that already is very useful, because having awareness of what is happening in your mind helps you to get self-knowledge, helps you to find out where your blockages are. Yeah, what are your desires? What are your problems and perhaps a little bit of ill will and whatever? You become more clear about those things on a retreat like this. So just watch your mind and see what happens. See what comes up. Or you can do it even simpler, even more simple. It's always good to have awareness of your mind, of course, but you can just focus on just enjoying the walking back and forth, enjoying the peace of this place, having a good time, and of course the awareness of the mind kind of becomes part of that. But just relax a little bit. You've been sitting down, and maybe your meditation has come to a natural end. It's not really natural to go back to samatha meditation, so just enjoy being here. Walk back and forth and see what arises, and enjoy the peace of this place. It really depends on what you need. This is kind of the critical issue here. What is the right thing for you to do at this time? If you feel a bit tense, you need to relax a little bit, then just walk back and forth and enjoy the place. If you feel that you have been sitting, your meditation has been going really well, you want to continue that, then you can even watch the soles of your feet as you watch back and forth and gain some good samadhi while doing walking meditation. If you just want to do something different, then you can contemplate a theme. Your meditation may have been going well here, now you want to do some contemplation. See how the death contemplation goes after you've had some samadhi. See how the impermanence contemplation goes. Reflect back on the process you had while you were sitting. See the impermanence of phenomena. See how things are changing as you are sitting down and doing the breath meditation. All of these things are things you can do. And it's really up to you to find out what feels natural, what feels easy, what works at any particular time. in the end, we have to take that responsibility for our own meditation. This is one of the reasons I don't really like systems so much. Systems will say, okay, sit down, watch the breath. But what if you're not ready to watch the breath? Usually we're not ready for that. It takes time to be ready for that mentally. If you tell people to watch the breath straight away, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's not going to be nice. You may not get anywhere. So read the instructions and then ask yourself, what should I be doing now? Yeah, and then you're heading in the right direction. Okay, so I hope that helps. So see what happens. Dear Ajahn, this is very interesting. What is the right view? It is the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, including the knowledge of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So just quoting there from the sutta this morning. Then, what is the way leading to the cessation of suffering? It is the Noble Eightfold Path, including right view. Yes, exactly. That's what I said. It's kind of recursive, yeah? This certainly is a loop. Looking forward to a discussion on this, please. With much metta, thank you. yes, so it is kind of, it exists within itself in a sense. So you start off with right view. Part of right view is the path because you understand the path, yeah? That's why it is part of right view. And part of that path, again, is right view. So it is kind of interlinked and looped. It's a recursive kind of thing, yeah? So, you don't have to worry to make too much complications of that. You don't have to kind of set this up mathematically. I think we have a mathematician here on the retreat. If she wants to, she can maybe set up an equation with this and kind of work it all out and see what it looks like. But you don't really need to do that. The point is just that to practice the path, you have to have right view, and a part of that right view is actually understanding the path itself, yeah? So as you practice the path, it means that you get more clarity about what that path is. That is part of what it means. So as you practice the path, remember, in the beginning, we are just kind of fumbling around a bit, yeah? We don't really know exactly what the path is. Part of the problem is that you don't know 100% what are the wholesome and unwholesome qualities of mind. And that's why you can't get to samadhi, because you are still trying to find your way through this, find a way past these kind of unwholesome qualities. So because you don't know what they are, we are trying to develop that understanding. That's part of it. So after a while, you understand the path better and better and better, until one day, bang, you see the path. That's when you know what it is like. So you are developing, part of development of right view is to develop the understanding of the path. As you practice that path to the best of your ability, you get more clarity about those Four Noble Truths, which includes understanding the path itself. Yeah? That's roughly what the meaning of this is. But don't make too much complications out of it. Just kind of, get the rough idea what's going on. Okay. Should one continue on nimitta light until reaching jhana? Yes, that is exactly right. Yeah, so if you do get a light, an obasa or nimitta in your meditation, that is wonderful. If you can do that, that's great. There are, it's quite not that uncommon for people to get to that stage on a retreat like this. Some people certainly do get these things. If you don't get it, it's okay. Don't kind of expect it, don't crave for it, just enjoy what you have. But that is really the gateway to jhana, yeah? So you just stay with that nimitta, stay with it. And as you stay with it, it kind of it becomes brighter, more powerful, more still, until eventually it draws you in. And that's where you enter the jhana stages, yeah? There's like a kind of a movement there from the nimitta into those jhana stages. That is exactly what you have to do. So you're not doing anything at all. You're just kind of hanging out and enjoying yourself, yeah? And as you enjoy yourself, the joy increases, becomes even more powerful. So just be content with what you have and just enjoy yourself. Then you are on the right track. It's a great path, isn't it? Yeah? Just all you have to do is just enjoy yourself, doing nothing at all. Yeah? What a wonderful thing that is. Yeah, everything in the world is about striving to find meaning, striving to find purpose. Here you find everything by the exact opposite. No striving, and you get everything you ever wanted by doing absolutely nothing. Yeah, it's just so contrary to kind of worldly ideas. It is so great. And this is kind of what I have been taught by Ajahn Brahms. I'm thoroughly brainwashed by his kind of his teachings, passing it on to others. Okay. So, next one. Wow, this is a really good one. This is a four-word. It's not even. It ends with an exclamation mark. Thank you so much. Yeah, these are the kind of questions I like. Yeah. Non-question questions. Okay, great. That's very kind. Very kind of you to say that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, I have read that people who experience near-death report, seeing their own body from above going through the tunnel and having a very deep sense of peace. Sometimes they can even communicate with deceased relatives. Is this the same as the experience? Is this the same as a real death or something else? And it seems very obvious to me that it is the same experience as a real death. That is what happens when you die, yeah? And then the only difference is that if you really die, you don't go back to the body again afterwards. But this actually is, these are real experiences. People who have this experience say they are very, very powerful and very real. If you're going to start doubting your experiences, you might as well doubt what you had for breakfast this morning. Yeah, I mean, it's pointless sometimes to doubt some of these things because they are very powerful and clear things. Of course, sometimes we have delusions, sometimes we see things that aren't real or whatever. But usually you have some degree of knowledge. If you are careful and you are wise about it, you will have some degree of ability to distinguish between mental fabrications and what actually is real. So I would say these things are generally real, but not everybody has these kind of experiences. Yeah, some people also have very negative experiences when they have a near-death experience. And of course, that is what we should expect, because some people will have some bad karma that they have to ripen. Yeah, so they will have something slightly scary when they are about to die. These things also happen. It's often not as much reported because everybody wants to have the good news, but actually it is there in the near-death literature. If you read it more carefully, you find these kind of reports as well. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teachings. Can you kindly please explain 5 aggregates, form, feeling, perception? I missed the last two. Okay, the last two are sankhara. Sankhara means the will, the volition. It means choice, choosing, yeah, making choices. It means intention. It is the doer inside. That's what it really is. Sankhara is the when you decide you're going to act, that is sankhara, the doing aspect of life. And the very last one is consciousness. In other words, awareness, the ability to know. The fact that you can know anything at all is due ultimately to consciousness itself. Yeah, the ability to be aware. That's what it is. So form is feeling is, does it feel good, bad, or neutral? Perception is your ability to make sense of the world. Sankhara is the doing, yeah, the act, the kind of the mind wanting to do things. And vijnana, consciousness, is awareness itself. What is the use of knowing the 5 aggregates? the use is the purpose of these kind of classes. It's a good question, actually. It's a very good question. And the purpose of these things is that what we are trying to achieve on the Buddhist path is to see things in accordance with reality. Yeah. And one of the things that the Buddha says that we're not seeing clearly, we're not seeing that our personality is empty of an inherent essence. There's nothing inherent inside of us. If you look inside of yourself, and that's what we're doing as part of the meditation practice, all you see is fluctuating phenomena, always changing. There's nothing inherent there. So the 5 aggregates is a scheme to help us investigate our personal traits and characteristics, because these are the areas where we tend to see a self, we tend to see something permanent, yeah? And that is why we are looking at things in this way. So the most basic of these things is form. Form is the sense of a physical body, of a physical reality around us, the five senses and all of that. And of course, form, as you become deeper and deeper in meditation, the more that world of form disappears. Your senses start to turn off. You don't feel your body so much anymore. It starts to disappear. You start to understand the impermanence of form. If it disappears, it's got to be impermanent, yeah? Secondly, you start to understand the suffering of form, because as the form disappears, you feel better. So you're feeling better must mean that the form was suffering. Then if it disappears completely, as it does when you get into deep samadhi, you understand that it is non-self, because something which can disappear completely cannot be an inherent element of what you are. If it is inherent in you, it always has to be there. If it can disappear completely, it means it cannot be inherent. So you start understanding the idea of non-self. This is how these things are done. Feeling, similar kind of thing. You see certain feelings disappearing through your meditation practice. And as you see certain feelings disappearing, the pain, afterwards certain happiness, happy feelings disappear until you're left with pure equanimity, you see the feelings disappearing, you know they are impermanent. You know that it's nice to get rid of them, and you know ultimately that they are non-self. Yeah, perception, same thing. Your perception gets simplified until all you have is like perception of happiness in the jhana states. Volition, the will, the sankhara, the choice, the doing activity of the mind. Yeah, as you become more and more peaceful, the mind becomes more and more still. There's less and less doing going on. If your mind is still moving, it means that there is doing going on, because it is the sankhara which drives the movement of the mind. When the mind is absolutely still, the sankharas, the doing, is also completely gone. So you see, quite literally, the impermanence of this thing we call the doer. You see that the doer disappears. It can't be part of yourself. It can't be part of who you are. Because if it can disappear completely again, it's not an inherent part of your personality. And these are very profound insights. Because we identify so much with the doer. Yeah, I'm the doer in the world. I get out. I get things done. But actually, you realize, no, you are not. This is just another illusion. Yeah, so this is the purpose of these five aggregates. And the final one is vijnana. You see the same thing with consciousness itself. It starts to disappear, gets less and less. Until finally, consciousness itself also disappears. Yeah, that too is non-self. This is the purpose of this. This is why we have these kind of divisions dividing up, to enable, to help us with having insight into these things. These are very profound matters, so I hope you don't mind. Okay. Craving is a source of suffering, as you taught. How do we reduce that habitual craving in daily life? Okay, so how do you reduce the habitual cravings in daily life? Well, basically, you practice the path, yeah? And the first reduction is simply to undertake to live morally and live well. So by living morally and living well, you're already certain cravings that are out of bounds, because you know it doesn't fit with the precepts and all that kind of stuff. That is the first kind of restraint, of holding back, that stops craving. Yeah. The second factor which stops craving is that as you develop the path, as you develop all these other factors, gradually, often it takes time. Yeah, this path really takes a lot of commitment and perseverance over long periods of time. But as you do that, as you develop the kindness and all these other aspects of the path, you start to find happiness in other areas of life. And when you do that, the craving naturally dies down, because those things that you crave for are not as interesting anymore. This is why if you are a habitual samadhi attainer, you find all your happiness through samadhi, through meditation, that's why you don't have any desire for the sensual realm anymore, because you have a higher happiness that is available to you. Gee. So this is how you gradually decrease these things. Another way of gradually decreasing the cravings in daily life is to reflect on the limitations, on their problems, to understand why they are problematic. And I will talk a little bit more about that later on in this retreat. It's a fairly large topic, but also very interesting. And as you reflect on the problems of those cravings, they're not so attractive for you anymore, and you start to distance yourself a bit more. But don't be too concerned about the craving, because far more important to deal with than the craving is the ill will. If you can reduce your ill will in your life, have much more metta and compassion, what you will find is that as you reduce the ill will, you also actually reduce the craving. Very often, craving is a response to suffering. If you have a lot of ill will in your life, you're also going to have a lot of suffering. The less ill will you have, the less suffering you have, you will have less craving as a consequence. We respond to suffering by craving because we need that happiness to build us back up again. So by reducing ill will, you're also reducing craving. Focus on that, because it's far easier to reduce ill will than it is to deal with the craving directly. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you very much for sharing your time and wisdom with us. It is such a privilege to be here. And it's very kind of you to say that, and I find it a privilege to be here myself, to be honest, because it is nice just to hear the suttas, even if I'm the one who reads them, it's still nice to hear the suttas. And it's nice to be here, yeah, in a good atmosphere, in a good place. So it's always nice. How many sutta retreats have you done at Rana Grove? Okay, the first one in 2012, really? Okay. I have no idea how many I've done. It's not that many, actually. It's not. It's kind of one or two a year, you know, like some weekend retreats and one sometimes the nine-day retreats. I'm not sure, maybe 10 or something like that. Probably not more than 10 altogether. And some of those would be weekend, some of them would be nine-day retreats. But I do also a lot of sutta retreats overseas. Yeah, it's so popular everywhere. Everybody loves the sutta retreats. Especially in Sri Lanka, they really love the sutta retreats. They're really, Sri Lankans are very keen on the suttas. It's actually very nice, and you do it there. You get large groups of people coming to listen to sutta retreats, which is very, very inspiring, actually. But everywhere, really, it's interesting. Yeah, you go to Singapore, people are very interested over there as well. You go to Malaysia, interesting. You go to Indonesia, people are interested. This is kind of my niche, the sutta retreat, because nobody does it quite like this, yeah? I discovered this a few years ago. There was a loophole there, kind of sneak in, and do things your own way. Yeah, and it has turned out to be very successful. People really enjoy these things, and which is great. Yeah, get it straight from the word of the Buddha. It's such a wonderful thing. And of course, a lot of the things that I say is my commentary on these things. So always be, you know, don't take it as 100% for granted that I'm always saying the right thing. But it kind of gives you access at the very least. And then you can start studying a bit more yourself in the future. That's how I started out, listening to Ajahn Brahma. And then gradually you become more independent as you continue with this. So I go to Hong Kong as well. I go to teach sutta retreats. Yeah, I'm going to England. That's just next week. I'm going to teach an eight-day sutta retreat in England. And there's 50 people. They book their places and snapped up like that. Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? It's everywhere. It's kind of this hunger for sutta retreats. It's really cool. So there you are. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is rebirth happening every micro-conscious moment? And that dependent origin also describes rebirth, i.e. before we take a thought, speech, or bodily action. Is rebirth happening every micro-conscious moment? Not the rebirth you find in the suttas. The rebirth you find in the suttas means you come to the end of your life, you die, and then you get reborn. Yeah, that's kind of the rebirth of the suttas. But there are people who have tried to redefine the idea of rebirth, and they have kind of said that, well, you know, there's another way of looking at rebirth, because your sense of self kind of gets reborn all the time and this kind of stuff. And it's an interesting idea, you know, and it's interesting to kind of look at things in that way. But you have to be careful not to take it too far, because it is not really the way the Buddha talks about these things. When the Buddha says rebirth, he actually means rebirth in the ordinary sense. And this is important because it actually affects how we interpret the suttas overall. It's actually very important. It affects, very importantly, as you point out here, how we interpret a dependent origination. Yeah, if we interpret, if rebirth is every microconscious moment, if that's what it means, then dependent origination becomes something very different from the way I understand it, what it means. In other words, it involves the very ordinary idea of rebirth. Yeah, you actually do get physically reborn. You die and you get reborn. That is what is meant in dependent origination as well. And I really can't follow those people who say it means otherwise. I think it is. I honestly think it's completely wrong. And that's really all I can say about that. So, and if you read the suttas, you know, it is actually defined in there. You know, the death is said to be the breaking up of the body, the kind of the laying down of the carcass. It's quite nice, right? The laying down of the carcass. I like that kind of little it's kind of nice little touch there. And rebirth means, you know, being established in a particular group of beings. Yeah, old age means the brokenness of the teeth, the graying of the hair. It can't be much more explicit than that. You can't really interpret that as mind moments. Yeah, this obviously refers to the physical body breaking down and dying. So I really don't understand how they can sustain that from a sutta perspective. And a lot of that comes from, I think, ideas, you know, that people have been trained perhaps in Western philosophy, then maybe sometimes not ready to accept the idea of rebirth, or they use Western philosophical ideas to interpret the suttas, but you can't really do that. These are teachings that come out of India. You can't really interpret them from a Western existentialist point of view or something like that. It doesn't make any sense. You have to interpret them in that context in ancient India where they came out from. Otherwise, you get it all completely wrong. You know, the Buddha was not an English gentleman. Yeah, so this is kind of the problem. He was an Indian. He was part of the Indian culture, and you have to read it in that way. Anyway, let's move on to the next one. Thank you, Ajahn Brahmali, for your teachings. May I ask, what is the difference between meditation and mindfulness? Okay, and this is a good question, because this is very often very confusing these days, because the word mindfulness is used everywhere around the world, and it is used in ways which almost kind of makes it equivalent to meditation practice. Yeah, but that is not how it is used in the suttas. In the suttas, mindfulness just means that you have an awareness in the present moment. You are in the here and now. You know what's going on. Yeah, you know what's happening in a particular area. For example, you have mindfulness of your mind. You know whether you're thinking good thoughts or bad thoughts, for example. That's mindfulness directed to a particular area. Yeah, so mindfulness just means the ability to be in the here and now, the ability to not drift off into the future and the past, and have a certain degree of clarity about the here and now. That is really sati, the Pali word sati. The Pali word sati also means memory. It means the ability to recall, because the more clarity you have in the present moment, the more clarity, the more ability you also have to remember properly. So memory and sati, memory and clarity go together very powerfully here. If you do something and you have very strong sati, very strong mindfulness when you do something, it will be easy to recall later on. This is one of the tricks of remembering when you are generous, for example. You do an act of kindness towards somebody, whatever it is, be mindful when you do that. If you are very mindful, you will remember that act much, much better later on. So mindfulness is a very general term that applies in daily life. It applies at all times. It also applies in meditation. They cannot have any meditation without mindfulness. So you have to. That's why we have to establish mindfulness before meditation happens. But meditation is more than mindfulness. Meditation is about how we apply the mindfulness. So you are mindful, and you also watch. You use that mindfulness to watch the breath. You don't use it for some other purpose. You use it specifically to watch the breath. That's meditation practice. Where you place the attention is what makes it meditation. And then eventually it becomes samadhi. The mind becomes still and peaceful and all of that. We're slowly coming to the end of this. There's lots of questions today, which is always nice. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahmali, is a prematured baby born alive for a few days only considered as living a rebirth? But what does that short rebirth act out as? Is it good or bad? Please comment. Many thanks with much metta. A premature baby that born and is alive only for a few days, it is a human rebirth. Yeah, that's what it is. But sometimes human rebirths go wrong. Yes, they don't actually turn out as it's supposed to turn out. And then, of course, the baby dies. It could be because of karma in the past. That is a possibility, that you only get reborn and then you die again. But not necessarily. Not all death, early death, is a result of karma. Sometimes it's just a result of circumstances. Yeah, sometimes life just is short. You get reborn as a human being, there's no guarantee that you will have a long life. Except perhaps if you have made lots of good karma in the past, that might then support your long life. So just because you live long does not necessarily mean that that is a result of bad. Just because you live short is not necessarily a result of bad karma from the past. It can be just accident or whatever. The suttas are very clear about this. They say there's lots of reasons for why we experience things in the world. And one of them is like assault, or you get sick. Yeah, and it doesn't say that this is karma. It just is because that's what happens in the world. Sometimes you get assaulted. Sometimes you get sick. That's life. And sickness, of course, can lead to death, etc., etc. So what happens then to that baby? Let's say the baby is premature and it dies. Well, what very likely happens after that, because it had the karma to be reborn as a human being, very likely when it dies, it will then get another chance to be reborn as a human being, yeah, afterwards. So you don't have to be too sad if that happens. Okay, the baby dies, then it moves on very likely to another human rebirth, because it hasn't had any chance to make any bad karma as a baby. It means that it will continue with that karma from the past it had before. So it's not a terrible thing if a little baby dies. Yeah, it's not okay. It may be terrible for the parents because they want you to have a child or whatever, but in the big picture of things, it's not necessarily a terrible thing. Yeah. So good, bad, who knows? Yeah, that's exactly right. Good, bad, who knows? It's a little bit uncertain, basically. Yeah. Ajahn Brahmali, in the last sentence of this morning sutta, the Kesavada Sutta, what does it mean to dwell pervading one quarter? Okay, so this is the kind of standard explanation for metta in the suttas, how you develop the Brahma Viharas. And what it means is that when you develop the metta to the world, you kind of expand your mind out to include all beings, yeah? But you start off with you don't start off necessarily with the whole world, you start off with kind of segments of the world. So one quarter, the world is divided into four quarters, yeah? North, south, east, and west. So one quarter is just one of those directions. That's really what it means. So imagine in your mind, yeah, you're starting to get peaceful, you're starting to get some good feelings coming up, and then you wish all the beings in the northern direction, you wish them well. May you be happy and well. And you see all the good qualities in those beings in the north. Yeah, and then you wish them well. And in that sense, you are pervading that area, that direction, with metta. And you allow it to expand as much as you possibly can, to have as much goodwill as you can develop through your meditation. And then you do it through all the quarters, and eventually you encompass the whole world, everything you encompass, by developing it gradually, one quarter after the other. That's essentially what it is about. I'm going a little bit fast now because it's nice to finish off and it's getting a bit late, so that is the reason. Bhante, thank you for conducting this retreat, Sadhu times three. Please kindly elaborate on the phrase Sila Bhatta Paramasa with special attention to lay practice. Much anumodana and metta. Sila Bhatta Paramasa. What does it mean? What it means is Paramasa means to grasp. Sila means virtue. It means habit. It means our conduct. And Bhatta or Vatta means like behaviors or, you know, conducts that we take up in our life. Yeah? And in India in those days, it was kind of, people did all kind of strange practices as part of their spiritual life. And these were kind of the vattas that people would undertake. So what exactly does it mean in lay practice? And what it means is that this is one of the fetters that you give up when you become a stream enter. Yeah? So once you become a stream enter, you don't grasp anymore to your sila, to your morality, to your habits. That's what it actually means. Yeah, so it is really an explanation of what happens when you become a stream enter. It is not so much a prescription for what to do. We have to distinguish between what is a description for what to do, call it a prescription if you like, yeah, how to act, on the one hand, and the results of the practice on the other hand. This here is not really, in my opinion, it's never really meant and said in that way in the suttas. It is not meant to show you what to do. It is meant to show the result of the practice so you can recognize the result when they arrive. That's how it is used in the sutta. So it is a factor of stream entry. This does not mean that you should try to abandon your attachment to your sila. Yeah? That's getting it in the wrong order. That happens automatically when you become a stream enter. In fact, I would recommend you to hold on a little bit to your sila. If you don't hold on a little bit to your sila, basically you're going to break it. Yeah, you have to hold on a little bit to it. Otherwise, you're just allowing the defilements to do their work. That's really what happens. So hold on a little bit. When you see you're about to break a precept, then walk away. Say no, don't do it. If you don't have any holding on to those, you're not going to be able to say no in those situations. So don't look upon this as a description for what to do, regard it as a result of the practice. That is the right way, in my opinion, to look at this. So don't be afraid of grasping a little bit onto these important things, because you have to grasp anyway. The sense of self, as long as it's there, and makes sure that you will grasp a little bit. So grasp onto the good things and let go of the bad things. Thank you for your teaching. It's amazing and highly inspiring. I'm very happy to hear that. That's great. Could you please lead a death meditation as early in this retreat as possible? Okay, so someone who's leaving soon, is that right? Or no? Or is it... You don't want to take any chance. Maybe you die beforehand, yeah? So you want to get as soon as possible in case you're going to die. So you are ready for that. Okay, sure, we will see what we can do. So it's actually too late already to do it as soon as possible. But anyway, we will do it soon. Dear Ajahn, kindly elaborate a bit more on how practicing meditation reduces the five aggregates from arising. And why is it important to reduce them from arising? Thank you, Ajahn. It's not so much that... practicing meditation reduces the five aggregates from arising. It's not so much that. It's just that the five aggregates die down in your meditation practice. Yeah, what I mean is simply that if the five aggregates is your experience, if you sit here with open eyes and your ears are open and you're feeling your body, there's a lot of stuff going on. Yeah, a lot of things happening, lots of feelings. Oh, knees are getting a bit sore. Yeah, and all of this. Just by closing your eyes, you're already reducing the five aggregates because you are seeing less. The deeper you go in your meditation, the less things are happening, the less there is of the five aggregates. Why? Because there is less experience going on. This is what I mean by the five aggregates being reduced. Yeah? You are just calming down, becoming more and more still. Less and less things are happening. So the consequence of meditation practice is that there is less happening. The aggregates are slowly fading away. And it's happiness. It's so blissful when that happens. You all know that already, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Yeah, you know what it's like to be peaceful. It's so much better than not to be peaceful. So you have some experience in what that means. That's really all I mean by this. Don't make the five aggregates fade away. Don't force that. Allow that to happen as a consequence of your meditation practice. And then notice it afterwards. Yeah, see, oh, the mind is peaceful. I'm not thinking so much. Yeah, I can't really... My senses are kind of less active than they used to be. My body is disappearing. There's only the breath left. And it feels really nice. Yeah, you can see there, as you do that, you see how all of this is fading away. It feels good. Less khandhas, more happiness. More khandhas, less happiness. That is really what I mean by this. Okay. Dear Ajahn, one of the five precepts is not killing. Does that mean it is wiser to be a vegetarian instead? Or is it acceptable to eat meat or fish for nutritious purposes? I think being a vegetarian is great. I think it's a good idea. If you can be a vegetarian, I think it's always wonderful, especially if you do it for out of compassion for animals. Yeah, certainly a positive thing. But you don't have to be a vegetarian. And especially if it is for nutritious purposes and you feel that you need it because for whatever reason, it is actually not... the Buddha didn't prohibit or tell us we had to be vegetarians. So there is a degree of flexibility there. Huh? Yeah, but I must admit, I think that there are many good reasons for being a vegetarian. I try to be a vegetarian myself most of the time. If people offer me meat, I eat that as well, because sometimes that's all you get, so you don't have much choice. But if I can be a vegetarian, I tend to be a vegetarian. When I go back home, I never tell my parents to cook me any kind of special food. Whatever they want to cook is fine. I will eat that. I don't try to make it a burden on other people, my own vegetarianism. So I'm a bit of a flexitarian, perhaps. I think it's a nice idea to be a vegetarian, so I would certainly encourage you, if that's where you're leaning. If for whatever reason you have to eat some meat and fish, please don't feel bad about that. Okay, dear Ajahn, could you please explain what emptiness means? Are emptiness and non-self interrelated? Thank you. Yes, indeed. That's exactly right. In the suttas, the idea of emptiness is very closely related to the idea of non-self. Why? Because it is said specifically that we are empty of a self. We are empty of an inherent essence inside of us. These are just two different ways of looking at the same thing here. So when the Buddha explains emptiness, one of the ways he does that, and this is in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the shorter sutta on emptiness, Majjhima Nikaya 121, middle length sayings number 121. There's also the long discourse, which comes straight afterwards. And the way he describes this is that he says that you look, you perceive whatever is missing right now. Yeah. So when you come here to Jhana Grove, yeah, you sit down, you close your eyes, a lot of things are gone. The city is gone. The noise of the city is gone. Yeah, and there's all that is left is this much simpler perception of Jhana Grove Meditation Center. That is one type of emptiness where you see that it is your perception you have now is empty of certain disturbing phenomena like the city and the cars and the people and all of that. And then you refine that down. Then when you kind of... start to go deeper in your meditation practice and you let go of the body and the five senses, after a while you realize it's empty of the... My perception is empty of the body. Yeah, it's empty of all of this irritation of the five senses and all of that. So the deeper you go in your meditation, the more empty you are, the less that is actually going on. This is another way of seeing the reduction in the five khandhas, yeah? You're emptying out the five khandhas. You're simplifying your perception. Things are becoming simpler and simpler. And sometimes that's a useful perception because you get this feeling that when things are empty, yeah, they are simplified. Again, it has a very positive connotation to it. Emptiness is a very positive thing. Simplicity, nothing, things not being there. And the more empty you are, the better things are as a consequence. Maybe we can have a look at that sutta one day. It's actually quite nice. Okay, last question for tonight. For those seeking suttas on specific topics, etc., have you thought of mentioning Sutta Central on the net? Adhan Sutta's project, everything is listed under topics and cross-references, I believe. Okay, I know who has written this, I'm not sure, but I think maybe I know. So yeah, please do that. It's a very good idea, because I was mentioning the other day that you can use books, but I forgot that nobody uses books anymore. Yeah, this is kind of ancient technology. I am one of those ancient people. I have books in my cuties and things. But for people who use mostly the internet, yeah, please you go to Sutta Central, and it's all there, and it's searchable according to indices and all of these kind of things. The index is taken from Access to Insight, another famous web page for suttas and things. So you just go there, and you can search according to all kinds of topics and things. That's perfectly right. So thank you, whoever said that, for mentioning that. It's actually a very good point. Okay, so there you are. That's all for this evening. So again, have a nice night, have a good rest, and then we will see you back again tomorrow morning. I'll probably come out at 8 o'clock tomorrow, and then we'll continue the suttas then. Sankho, Sankho.